sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
Today's show is the third in a series discussing how the official account of 9/11 falls apart no matter where you examine it. Joining me today for this discussion is Frank Tolupko, who is a 9/11 researcher and former radio show host on 9/11 in the Berkshires. Frank, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So again, on today's show, we're going to be looking at how the official account of 9/11 falls apart anywhere you look at it. And today we're going to be looking at in New York City, what happened there, the Twin Towers, World Trade Center 7, and the other World Trade Center buildings. And why would anyone want to do that? So just briefly, the official story of 9/11 in terms of the World Trade Center towers was that the two planes hit the Twin Towers and brought them down from the jet fuel, which weakened the steel, and then they collapsed. And then with Building 7, they're saying that it's the debris from the World Trade Center towers and fires that brought down Building 7, which wasn't hit by a plane. So let's start taking a look at the World Trade Center attacks. First of all, who owned the World Trade Center buildings, Frank?
Well, initially, it was built by the Port Authority of New York under a deal arranged by David Rockefeller, who had a lot of property in Lower Manhattan, which was losing value because it wasn't a place people wanted to necessarily work. But by building the World Trade Center and having somebody else foot the bill, the taxpayers, through the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, it raised the real estate values down there. So unfortunately, they were built a little too early for all the technology we have now, so they became essentially unusable in terms of wiring, computer access, etc., as we approach the turn of the century of 2000.
Right. Weren't they heavily filled with asbestos also?
Partially. Yeah. When they were building the first building, about halfway through, they said, hey, there's a lot of asbestos here. So at that point, they stopped using it. So there was some there that obviously was dispersed when the buildings were torn apart.
And so World Trade Center 7, the third building that collapsed on 9/11 that wasn't hit by a plane, was owned by Larry Silverstein, who worked out a deal with the Port Authority in 1980 to build World Trade Center 7. So he already owned that. And when did he acquire the other buildings from the Port Authority?
In the summer, was it the late spring or early summer of 2001, he put together a 99-year lease deal with the Port Authority of New York and essentially was the controller of what was going on there and immediately took out some major insurance policies also at the same time.
Right, he took them out for terrorist attacks.
Yes, exactly.
And he dined every morning at the Windows on the World. He dined there every morning for breakfast. And just conveniently, on the morning of 9/11, he wasn't there. And what was his reason for not being there?
I had a dentist appointment.
Yeah.
Evidently, he had a toothache or something like that.
And his children usually met him there, and they didn't go either that day.
That's good. There's a lot of people that didn't show up that day, including a lot of bankers and security analysts, et cetera, that did not. A lot of people did show up, but that's another story.
Yeah. So we have someone here locally, Richard Andrew Grove, who actually was going to a meeting that day in the World Trade Center towers, and he got stuck in traffic. So he never made the meeting, but lost a lot of coworkers that day. And interestingly, he had been trying to call the company's attention to some nefarious financial dealings. And had he reached the towers that day, he would have perished in the meeting. And the top executives who called the meeting in the first place were joining the meeting remotely, and so weren't even in the building at all that morning.
As I said earlier, there were some security traders, et cetera, that were in the building there and were doing trades before the buildings collapsed, and they knew that they had a certain period of time, it would appear, to do those trades, transfer money, maybe some into personal accounts, and vacated the buildings in time before they came down. So there were some people that knew what was going to happen, were doing stuff that was nefarious in nature, but left in time.
And isn't it the Securities and Exchange Commission refused to release all of that data on who was doing like the put options and trades that morning?
Well, yes, that is true. They did admit that some people did some put options a week or a few days before 9/11. But it was interesting. There was a little piece in the Times, like 2 inches, after their report was released. And they said, yes, some people made money on the put options, betting that the price of the airline stocks, the United and American Airlines, would fall. But no terrorist made any money from that. The point is then they don't say who did make the money on that and who knew ahead of time.
They must think we're really dolts to not see through that doublespeak, an illogical conclusion. So moving on, Willie Rodriguez was in the basement that morning. And he says that he heard explosions going off before the planes hit, and he actually has people that were in their six basement levels that were had their skin falling off because they, you know, had been bombed.
That is correct. And another person that's active in the 9/11 truth movement, Bob McElvain, his son, they did a forensic analysis of how he died. He died actually walking into the North Tower outside and was blown away by explosions in the building and glass, etc., you know, before the first plane hit. And they know that based on various forensic evidence that the coroner released, not unknowingly released, but shows that he actually died before the first plane had hit.
And there's so much evidence of controlled demolition in the towers that architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have documented, and I encourage people to go to their website if you want to look at the evidence. It's all there. It's ae911truth.org, and you can see for yourself what was going on there. They collapsed in roughly, I think it was like 11 seconds.
Yeah, just a little slightly slower than free fall speed, indicating that there was no resistance by the stronger lower parts of the building. They had to be blown away for that building to collapse in the way it did. And that's true of all three towers.
Right, and they collapsed in their own footprint. It had all the characteristics of a controlled demolition, and you can learn about that again at Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And if you have a wood stove, you know that burning and jet fuel is just kerosene, my understanding.
That's correct.
And it doesn't get hot enough to melt steel. And actually, no steel-framed building in the history of steel-framed buildings has ever collapsed due to fire, except for the three on 9/11.
It happened three times, and all on the same day, the same place.
Right. And then all the debris in the collapse of these towers, all the debris was immediately taken away.
Yeah, they immediately shut down the site, Mr. Giuliani did, and it was, you could be arrested if you had a camera anywhere near the site, and they were just trucking the stuff away to barges in the Hudson River right next to what was then the New Stuyvesant High School, which I'm an alumnus of, and they were just putting on these barges to be shipped to China.
So all the evidence
was essentially destroyed.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, by that being there, there's a lot of graduates, people in their 30s now that were in that high school. That are now dying of lung cancer and other stuff because told it was safe to be there.
Mm-hmm.
That's another tragedy of that.
Right.
The gift, you know, 9/11, right. The gift that keeps on giving.
As well as all the first responders. Yeah, that's really tragic. And it's illegal to remove evidence from crime scenes, and this was a crime scene, and they did this.
Well, like what was the president? That wasn't Reagan. It was President Nixon said, if the president does it, it's not illegal.
Yeah. So then we have World Trade Center 7, which was a 47-story building, and it housed Mayor Rudy Giuliani's Emergency Management Center. It also housed the CIA and the FBI and other government agencies. So I think it's hard to believe that anyone could get in there and wire it with explosives while they were in that building.
But the Hulsey report, which you may want to touch on now, that just came out on this anniversary, says that the only way the building could come down was by pre-planted explosives. So that had to be with the full knowledge of the people that were in there.
You would think, right?
I would think. How else would they be able to do
it? Right. This Hulsey report is really important. It took 4 years, and it was funded by Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And the guy who conducted the study was Dr. Leroy Hulsey at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. And he and two of his graduate students did this study over 4 years of the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And in the first part, they said that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which was charged with investigating how Building 7 collapsed, was totally wrong.
I mean, it just doesn't hold. It's impossible for the buildings to collapse the way they did. And we have photographic and video footage of how the buildings collapsed. It was impossible for them to collapse that way based on the report that NIST put out.
Right. And it collapsed in 6.5 seconds.
And NIST actually at some point was forced to admit in the first 2.5 seconds of its collapse that it was actually falling at free fall speed.
Yeah.
Therefore, admitting that there was no resistance below that. And the only way that could be is if you blow away the resistance and get it out of the way.
Right. And that's what Hulsey's report says happened.
They
blew that away. So there's some good news in the 9/11 truth-seeking world that this report has come out backed by his university, and it's actually open for comment. So if you go to the Architects and Engineers website, you can pull up the report and you can comment on it. So I encourage people to do that. So there's that going on. We also have, in World Trade Center 7, there was a man who worked for the Housing Authority in New York, and he was called into building.
He was a higher-up executive within the New York City Housing Authority.
Yeah, and he was in Building 7 that morning and in this emergency management center, And he said that he was walking over dead bodies, that there were explosions
in
the building.
Well, just to set the scene, all major executives within the city government were called when the first plane hit or whatever, mm-hmm. to report to that area. So he is a higher-up executive in the Housing Authority, came down there along with Michael Hess. I think he worked for, was he in the Giuliani administration? I forget what he did. Mm-hmm. And the reason they were there was because they were told to report down there, and they actually went into the building and went up to the emergency management.
It was on the 23rd floor.
And when they arrived there, there were coffee cups that were steaming, and there was uneaten English muffins, etc. But nobody there. Everybody had evacuated, and they said, what the heck is going on? They made a phone call, and they were immediately told, get out of the building at that point, which they proceeded to do. But on the way down, they heard explosions, and the stairways were compromised, and they could not initially get out. So they got to a window and were waving, etc., and they finally were rescued by, I guess, some police or the firemen, mm-hmm. etc., and they got out. But as they were walking out, as you had said, mm-hmm. they were already through the lobby. They were stepping over dead bodies, which means the building hadn't collapsed yet, hadn't been hit by a plane, minimal fires above, mm-hmm. like on the 7th or 8th floor, but yet there was dead bodies in the building, which indicates there was some other energetic event. I don't want to say explosions, but energetic event that killed these people.
Right, and the government official story, my understanding is that says that nobody died in Building 7 at all.
Yeah. Well, his story is another interesting one. So he stuck with that story, and then it's captured on tape of him describing this whole scene. And all of a sudden, he has a heart attack just before the NIST report is supposed to come out and supposedly dies. But the problem is that his whole family and his house was totally vacated, so who knows where he is. Sounds like something fishy going on with that.
And that was just 2 weeks before the report on how Building 7 had come.
I think it was the day before, literally. I think it was the day before that he had disappeared, gone.
Yeah, it was right before it, so certainly they didn't want him around when the report
And
came
meanwhile,
out
the other guy, Hess, Michael Hess, got a high-paying job in the Giuliani Partners law firm right after that. Once Jennings was gone, he told the exact opposite story and got paid well.
One other thing I wanted to bring up that kind of challenges the official story around the planes hitting the Twin Towers is that no planes came to intercept them.
Well, there were drills going on that day involving planes, involving either phantom planes or real planes, simulating an attack on the World Trade Center, because they were doing like a drill for that. FEMA had already arrived in town the day before 9/11 because they were going to do a drilling triage and mm-hmm. things like that. So, in fact, there is a video recording of one of the air traffic controllers who knew that there was some drills going on. And when they saw these planes and stuff going towards the World Trade Center, he actually says to his supervisor, is this real time or is that the drill?
Right.
They were confusing blips on the radar screens, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of confusion, not confusion because of what was going on, but it was actually probably programmed confusion. And the intercept planes were sent out to sea, certainly down in Washington, D.C. They didn't go towards the Pentagon. They went out into the ocean. They didn't send anybody out from Otis Air Force Base until it was too late.
And then they told them to go out to sea, too. They said
right.
they were directed to
go right.
out to
they slowed
yeah.
them down. So yeah, there are a lot of questions down, yeah. about that. And any time a plane goes off course, those the guys are gals, because there's mm-hmm. a lot of female pilots now. They're right on, you know, tailing these planes. They do that. And all of a sudden, this on the same, every one of them on that day. So.
Very, very odd. And then if we take a look at the 9/11 Commission Report, and I recommend David Ray Griffin's book, The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, where he documents over 100 omissions and distortions in the report. But one of their omissions is they don't mention World Trade Center 7 at all in their report. And they interviewed Willie Rodriguez in private, and his testimony never made it into their report about explosions going off before the planes hit.
Well, that's a real key thing. Another one is that the New York Times actually interviewed firemen that had been in that building that day. It was over 500 firemen, some of whom perished, but obviously the ones that survived. And I think it was like 120 or 125 reported hearing explosions. And that's not just somebody hearing a coffee pot blow up, but real explosions or describing them as going around the circumference of the building. That was not included in the report.
Right. And then we know from Philip Shannon's book, The Commission, that the outline for the 9/11 Commission report was already pre-written before they met by Philip Zelikow.
Oh, he had tight reins on that. He was getting rid of people anytime they were asking any sort of questions, or they were put into much lower positions on the commission. The staff that was hired, not the actual commissioners, put into lower positions where they wouldn't be able to cause trouble for the official story.
Right. And even the commissioners themselves have said they were set up to fail.
I had the opportunity to meet the head of the commission, former Governor Kane, who was the co-commissioner with Hamilton. And I asked them, I said, you know, that within the first couple of 9/11 Commission meetings, the story kept changing in terms of the chronology, what time the planes took off, what time they hit, who was where. There were like four different versions. And I asked them about that. And he says, you know, the government witnesses kept coming up with all these different stories, so the commission has decided to create their own timeline. I have that on tape. He actually says that. So that's not what an investigation is supposed to do. You don't create a timeline. You get it from who
from
was involved
evidence.
In that. Why were there four different versions, and why did the commissioners make up their own timeline at that point? Why? Because they had to fit it into the contradictory evidence that was showing that this couldn't happen there. So they had to come up with some new story that actually fit what they wanted it to fit. So
it's kind of like the Kennedy assassination, where the bullet had to go through several people before it hit Kennedy.
That's amazing that they would admit that. And they say, you know, I'm saying, duh, why? You have any other questions about this? I mean, well, I mean, some of them said it was set up to fail, but in what way to fail?
Well, and the lead legal counsel for them, John Farmer, wrote a book, and in it he said that we didn't have the truth from the commission.
Well, you know, there's truth and there's facts, et cetera. You know, when they first set up the commission, they say, we're not here to blame anybody. We want to see how we can prevent it from coming again. But if you don't blame anybody, so if you don't have a diagnosis, you don't have a cure. And they didn't want to do that because it was too many high ups. And most of the commissioners had some particular axe to grind that were representing people that had involvement with 9/11. I mean, we could go through the details, but that's something.
Right.
That's another show we can do.
Right. Frank, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the gentleman, Kurt Sonnenfeld, the guy who worked for FEMA photographing 9/11 right after it happened.
This guy named Kurt Sonnenfeld worked for FEMA. He was a cameraman for them. When 9/11 occurred, he was initially called in and told to photograph and video everything that you see where you can get in. He wasn't allowed on the site until, I think, the third day because it really was dangerous. So when he finally got in, they weren't just walking around showing people, you know, working in these horrendous conditions and, you know, clearing the site. But he actually got down to go down underground at certain places where he had access. And one of the places he had access was the Building 6, which was not a gigantic building. I think it was only 4, 5, or 6 stories high, but it had really been blown to smithereens. It was a big, big hole as if somebody dropped a, you know, a bomb in the middle of it. And then he got into the basement there. Building 6 is where a lot of gold bullion was stored, as well as securities, negotiable securities, some of which people didn't know about. And when they got to the area where they were stored, where the safes were, what he photographed and videographed was the fact that these safes were blown wide open. That's not what happens when a building collapses. And they were totally empty of any of the bullion and any of the securities. So you can't do that after the fact. That had been done before, within hours before this occurred. And so he came out with that information, and he actually had to leave the country.
Right.
But he held on to the tapes. He's actually living in Argentina now with that, and he's written, he says, you know, there's something going on. Why were those things emptied? Who has that money? What was the purpose of that? Which didn't make sense. He was actually then accused of murdering his wife that he had been, was divorcing or had already divorced, and they said that he killed her, accused of murder. But then the charges were thrown out because he actually came back to face the charges, and he went back to Argentina. And then the government wanted to come back again because they had new evidence they want to go after him. But all the forensic evidence indicates that the wife had committed suicide from various things, like he submitted to testing for gunpowder on his hands, a lie detector test. He passed all those tests. There was no way he could have done it. The thing is, I mean, it's 18 years later, and I haven't heard anything lately about this, so I think everybody wants to just keep quiet at this point.
Early on, he had posted a photo online of himself in Argentina, and you could see this guy hiding in a bush spying on him.
Maybe that was a setup. Anyway, he remarried down there, and he has a life. He has two children. The government, there was a woman, I forget her name, who was the head of Argentina at that point, refused to extradite him to the United States because she said Argentina is against the death penalty, and if they sent him back, he might be subject to the death penalty. So he's been safe there. Even though they've had a right-wing government, nobody's making any action at this point or doing anything to try to get him back here.
Mm-hmm.
Because in one way, he's been silenced.
Right.
The fact is that we haven't seen those films. But the fact is he's written and lectured and mm-hmm. made videos of what his position is, that this is very suspect evidence that he has.
Right. Yeah, and then we spoke the other day about the Naudé brothers who got the first video. And you have done some research on that and showed how they weren't really who they say they are and that it was all pretty suspect.
There's a lot of contradictory evidence there in terms of where they're from, who they worked for, and how mm-hmm. they could be at the right place at the right time. You know, they just showed my high school where Stuyvesant, as I had mentioned earlier in the program, they just made a film about that day, a 30-minute film that was on HBO last week, and I guess they're going to replay it, where they show these iconic shots of the first plane going in, and they happened to be in the right place at the right time to get the first shot. But interestingly, then after the first plane hits, they get into a car in their documentary movie, mm-hmm. and one of the brothers goes to a position south of the thing and is in the exact right position to catch the second plane going in. How do they know to be at that?
Exactly.
You know, once okay, maybe it just happened to be like, but mm-hmm. to get two in that?
Right.
And I think they made a mistake because they were videographing some of the firemen from one of the firehouses down there. And these guys are sitting around a table saying, yeah, we're standing there. We're hearing going boom, 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 all these explosions going off. It's in the film. I think they
didn't edit it soon enough. So, Frank, this leads us to the other buildings that were in the World Trade Center complex. You mentioned Building 6 with the gold. And maybe you can talk to us. I think you have a little more information about why they might want to do this. Why anyone would want to carry out 9/11? Who would benefit from that?
Well, this is a rather complicated story in terms of the finances involved in this. Mm-hmm. Not the financing of the event, but other financial considerations that were going on. Perhaps the best thing to do is read something that was written by somebody in 2008 by a guy named E.P. Heidner, who was a former employee of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency Office of Naval Intelligence. And he actually worked for them. Mm-hmm. And what he came up with, and he wrote these two massive papers saying that the 9/11 event was an event to hide some very nefarious financial transactions. And what he uses initially as evidence is what buildings were hit, where they were hit, and what was destroyed. And what it really goes back to is there were bonds that were coming due the next day. Perhaps I should read this. So it's actually something he wrote about 11 years ago. The attacks of September 11th were intended to cover up the clearing of $240 billion in securities covertly created in September 1991. So they were coming due 10 years later, right? Those bonds were issued to create a covert economic war against the Soviet Union, during which unknown Western investors bought up much of the Soviet industry with a focus on oil and gas. The attacks of September 11th also served to derail multiple federal investigations away from the crimes associated with the 1991 covert operation. In doing so, the attacks were justified under the cardinal rule of intelligence, quote, protect your resources, unquote, and consistent with a modus operandi of sacrificing lives for a greater cause. The case for detailed targeting, and his article, we can give a reference to it, the case for detailed targeting of the attacks begins with the analysis of the attack on the Pentagon. After one concludes that the targeting of the Office of Naval Intelligence in the Pentagon was not random, one then must ask, is it possible that the planes that hit the World Trade Center and the bombs reported by various witnesses to have been set off inside buildings 1, 6, and 7, and the basement of the towers were deliberately located to support the execution of a crime of mind-boggling proportions? In considering that question, a pattern emerges. For the crimes to be successful, the vault of the basement of the World Trade Center and its contents, less than $1 billion in gold, but hundreds of billions of dollars in government securities, had to be destroyed. A critical mass of brokers from the major government security brokerages in the Twin Towers had to be eliminated to create chaos in the government securities market, a situation needed to be created wherein $240 billion of covert securities could be electronically cleared, without anyone asking questions, which happened when the Federal Reserve declared an emergency and invoked its emergency powers that very afternoon. The ongoing federal investigations into the crimes funded by those securities, that's what we're talking about in Russia, needed to be ended or disrupted by destroying evidence in buildings 6, 7, and 1. Finally, one has to understand and demonstrate the inconceivable that $240 billion in covert and possibly illegal government funding could have been and were created in September of 1991. Filling in the last piece of the puzzle requires understanding 50 years of history of key financial organizations in the United States, understanding how U.S. intelligence became a key source of their off-balance sheet accounts, and why this was sanctioned by every president since Truman. Okay, close quote. What this really harks back to is actually the Second World War, believe it or not, when the United States finally were defeating the Japanese and kicking them out of the Philippines, they discovered hoards of gold bullion that the Japanese had sequestered there. They getting it because they were an imperial power in the 19th century themselves and were stealing gold from people just as the Nazis had done it. But what the Nazis had done was far less in the amount than what the Japanese had done and sequestered. But when they discovered that is the military forces, they put a clamp on it and they decided not to announce that to anybody or in the world. The CIA at that point was being created and they used that as a funding apparatus for a lot of the black ops that they did in these ensuing decades that came with that. And I think they called it the Black Eagle Fund or whatever. The Black Eagle comes from what the Nazis did when they stole gold. They remelted it and created bars and they put the stamp of a black eagle on it. And they had used that for many, many, many operations, which means they didn't have to go to authorization to Congress for getting funds. And they did the same thing in 1991 when they essentially bankrupted the Soviet Union and bought out a lot of the stuff. That went into that same fund. Well, to do some of these operations, they issued bonds in 1991. And again, this is very compressed. I could write two books on this whole thing. So they issued these bonds that were coming due on September 12, 2001. So one of the reasons, I think, was to destroy evidence of that and have the actual bonds could be covered and the money laundered through issuance of federal money. Then again, we paid the price for that to cover it up because there's no evidence. And the Federal Reserve had the right to do that. They said, if we can't find the original owners of the bonds, we're going to issue new bonds. And that's what they claimed. Well, somebody had to be in Building 6 to destroy those bonds. That's where they were stored. Mm-hmm. That's why those things were emptied and destroyed.
I suspect that when they know they're going to pull something like this off, then they look at how else can we benefit by this? What else can we do? So they had the plans for the war in Afghanistan on the table before 9/11, and then after they were, a month later and were in Afghanistan. So all of those things come into play.
They're saying, we're going to do this. Yeah. I think it works that. Here's the primary reason. Yeah. Well, here's what else we can do. Hey, we can have a Patriot Act. Hey, the Russians are not there anymore. The Soviets are not any there. We got to create a new enemy. Hey, the Arabs. Sure, they're the ones that could create the terrorists, et cetera. So again, there's many, many, many benefits.
Right. Well, thank you for that, Frank. And unfortunately, we're running out of time, so thank you for being on the show for a third time this month. I really appreciate that, and hopefully we'll hear from you again.
Okay. Maybe we can continue on this story, because it really is fascinating in terms of what was done that day financially. It's unbelievable. They had just moved the Office of Naval Intelligence, who was investigating some of this stuff, because there are actually people that are out of the loop and say, hey, we see something going on, it's wrong.
Right.
So they actually moved them from the old Navy building a month before 9/11 into that section that was destroyed.
Yeah.
Some would say a plane, but mostly I would think by internal explosions. Right.
So, Frank, how can people learn more about this topic of the bonds?
Go to archive.org. And search on E as in every, P as in Peter, Heidner, H-E-I-D-N-E-R, H-E-I-D-N-E-R. Search on that. And two articles will come up, one describing what we've just talked about in much more detail. And interesting, he has a second article indicating that the gold that they had to put out there and float in the market was actually one of the causes of the 2008 financial crisis, because of all the gold and money that was out there that could be lent to people. It was very, very interesting. So this is a continuum from the Second World War all the way up to 2008, and it's still going on, 2018. Mm-hmm.
And Frank, thanks again for being on the show and for sharing your vast knowledge of 9/11. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people.